Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Greed isn't good. With billions of dollars in shareholder value wiped out by the ongoing global financial turmoil, a cardinal and a financial entrepreneur take a look at what lessons we can learn from this crisis. Christians living in fear. We shine the spotlight on the plight of tens of thousands of Christians driven from their homes after riots and rampages by Hindu extremists in the Indian state of Orissa. And papal audience. Pope Benedict talks about the role of the cross of Jesus in the preaching of St. Paul at his weekly general audience.
Money! It's a crime. Share it fairly, but don't take a slice of mine.
Money is nothing. We see it now in the collapse of the great banks that money disappears. Those were the words that Pope Benedict used to comment on the ongoing global financial crisis that has wiped away billions of dollars in shareholder wealth in recent weeks and sent many nations hurtling towards a full-blown recession. The turmoil is the worst since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And has ensured that economics and money have been discussed and analysed to a greater extent than ever before by the international community. As the Pope reminded us earlier this month, building one's life on material things is like building on sand. And the current financial turmoil has highlighted the fragility and ephemeral nature of monetary wealth. Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga of Tegucigalpa in Honduras is president of Caritas Internationalis. He says he's particularly worried about the knock-on effects the financial crisis will have for the world's poor.
I am afraid and sorry and suffering because, you know, with this financial crisis, what do the big nations do? The first thing is to cut the aid, and it's wrong. We don't have aid for the poorest, and we have aid for the richest. And all the efforts are concentrated in protecting banks and financial institutions. Okay, I understand. Economy has to be healthy. But what is not healthy is not economy. It's the human beings that are leading economy. Because economy is not a person. We cannot blame it. President Bush was saying the economy is not behaving. No, that's a mistake. Those who are not behaving are the leaders that are taking money illegally or maybe legally but immorally. And so we need to enhance that persuasion, that conviction that you have limits. All of us have limits because we are human beings and we have to respect the limits, especially of honesty and truth.
That was Cardinal Rodriguez Maradiaga.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money.
Money, money, money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money, money, money.
Everyone must hanker for the bunchness of a banker. It's a count.
Many experts say the current financial crisis shows what happens when money is lent or borrowed or simply spent unwisely or imprudently. So a new book just published entitled What Money Means and How to Use It Well sounds like a timely subject during these troubled times. The book is written by Frank Hanna, a member of the Papal Foundation. Hanna is a Catholic financial entrepreneur and philanthropist from Atlanta, Georgia, who has been given awards for his generosity. I began by asking Hanna what prompted him to write this book in the first place.
I have spent a lot of time in business on the effort of making money and creating wealth. And I found that when it came time to spend it, it was much tougher to find good advice from other people and good training on how to use your money wisely. And so upon seeing this dearth of information out there, I thought to myself, you should at least be as deliberate and thoughtful in the spending and using your money as you have been in the creation of the wealth. And so that's really what prompted me first to understand it myself. How ought you to use this money well and wisely? And upon doing that, I thought others may benefit from this. And so one thing led to another, and it led to the publication of the book, because I received a lot of good feedback from a number of people saying, I've been wondering about some of those questions myself, but it's hard to think about them, and I don't know what the answers are or where to find the answers.
So if you had to sum up in one sentence the message you were trying to get across in this book, what would it be?
It would be that money is not a bad thing. It is a good thing. But it is a good thing if it is used as it is intended to be used. And that is to make us better people, to make us more virtuous, and to help us make those who are around us more virtuous.
Money has often been called, though, the root of all evil. Indeed, having lots of money can be an obstacle to being virtuous. How would you answer that?
Money has at times been mistakenly called the root of evil, but it is the worship and the pursuit of money that can lead to evil. Money is a representation of wealth, and wealth is a good thing. It is a blessing from God. However, if we get attached to anything in place of our attachment to God, it becomes an evil thing. It becomes literally something that we are better off burning and doing away with if it's going to get between us and our relationship with God.
The release of your book coincides with the current worldwide financial crisis. Did you foresee this coming?
I did not foresee it, and it's probably providential for the success of the book that it happened to come out right now. But we should remember this financial crisis entails an opportunity for each of us to reorient ourselves toward those things which are most important, which are most real. Pope Benedict recently spoke about this when he spoke about what we build our lives on, and that we should build our lives on that which is the primary reality, meaning our relationship with God and the love we have for one another. And I think this time of financial crisis is a chance for each of us to look within ourselves and say, is my own hierarchy of value and the way I spend my life and the way I think about what I'm attached to, is that hierarchy in the proper order that it ought to be?
Coming back, though, to the financial crisis, do you agree with those who say that the unregulated capitalism as practiced by the US and many other Western nations, and particularly the greed and incompetence of many in the banking world, are to blame for this mess we're in?
I think there is a temptation during any crisis to find a scapegoat, because if we can find a scapegoat and pin all the blame on that one party or set of parties, then we all feel blameless and we feel better about ourselves. I don't believe we can point the finger at one party or another party. The fact is that many people throughout the globe, I can speak particularly about the United States, have acted imprudently with the money that is in their care. That is the person who took out a mortgage larger than what they could afford. It's the person who ran up more debt to buy television sets and go on fancy vacations that they couldn't afford. It's the people on Wall Street who took on more debt than they can afford. And so certainly there is blame to go around for the government, which created institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that got into the mortgage business. So there are a lot of fingers that can be pointed. But I don't think we can look at one segment of society, the bankers on Wall Street, and say, they put us into this mess. That's short-sighted. Anyone, our neighbor or ourselves, who acted imprudently with wealth and took on more debt than they could reasonably afford to take on, acted in an imprudent manner and is part of the problem.
So what specific lessons can we learn from it? And more to the point, how can we avoid it happening again?
Well, I think the first thing we can start to think about is why did I get into this situation? Why did I personally? Certainly we ought to look at what the government did, what various banking institutions did. But we can also look at ourselves and say, why am I in this situation? Have I become too materialistic? I actually believe that a more precise definition of what has happened to us is that we have become materialistic in a very consumer-driven culture. Greed, whether or not another person has greed, that's a matter of their heart. And it's very difficult to be judgmental about whether someone else is greedy or not. We can, though, look and say, it appears that our entire culture has become much more materialistic than maybe it had been in the past. And it's that attachment to these material things, which are not the first order of reality. And so I think it's a time for us to look at our own lives and how attached are we to these things. How spoiled have we made ourselves and our children in the way we spend our money? How have we spent the resources that it put in our care? And that's where I think we tend to falter, because we're not deliberate enough about it, which is exactly why I thought the book was needed, and it's fortunate that it came out at this time. It is a time to be much more thoughtful about how we use our money and how we use it on others.
Money makes a bird go round the bird, go round the bird. Money makes a bird go round the clinking, clanking sound. Money, 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 get a little, get a.
Now, coming back to what you mentioned before about Pope Benedict's remarks when he said that money is nothing, it's an illusion, and that whoever builds his life on material things, on success, builds on sand. Do you think that this is a message that will be heard and taken on board by, as you say, rightly, people in today's very materialistic world?
Fortunately, I am seeing, because I've been going around the country and for that matter, the globe a little bit, speaking about this in connection with the book, and I am seeing a hunger. People are realizing that putting our faith in that which was material, that faith does not reap dividends, or rather it reaps dividends, but they're not good dividends. And so I think there is a hunger right now. This is a crisis, and when we reorient ourselves, we can reorient one way or the other. We can either decide that attachment we had to these material goods was unhealthy, or we can actually become even more self-absorbed and hoard that which we have and become even more ungenerous. One of the things I speak about in the book is the happiest people I know are those who are generous with what they have, no matter how much it may be. We tend to confuse philanthropy, thinking that it's only something for people who are very wealthy. The richest people in the world are those who can be philanthropic. When in fact, philanthropy, which means the love of other people, that's the Greek words of philanthropy mean love of another person. Philanthropy can be engaged by all of us. It's an act of charity and sacrifice, and it's that generosity that makes us fully human. That's what separates us from our animal instincts, is when we choose to be generous with what we have and to sacrifice for others. And so I am seeing some hunger for that, and I think the Pope's words resonated on the day he said them and will continue to resonate.
Nonetheless, you have chosen to be generous with the money that you've made, but it is recognized that having lots of money can be an obstacle. I mean, let's remember Jesus, who said that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. There is a point he's getting across there, isn't there?
There certainly is, and I think at the root of that point is the fact that when someone obtains money, there is the appearance that they have more control over their lives. And what happens when we have more control over our lives, we start to forget who's ultimately in control of our lives. And so therefore we start to put more faith in ourselves. What I'm hopeful, this crisis is a terrible thing, but there are things that can be brought out of it that are good. God brings good out of everything. And so one of the good things that can come out of it is a realization that we are not independent of God. And in fact, we are not independent of others. We are far more interconnected, as we're seeing, as this contagion spreads around the globe, this financial crisis. We are all much more connected than we might have imagined. And so for those who do get attached to their money, who do put it in place of God, there's that risk that they believe they've got their own lives under control and they don't need God. That's why it's hard for a rich man to get to heaven, because he starts to put his faith in the riches that he has accumulated rather than in the source of those riches.
And do you give guidance in your books, or give guidance right here now talking to me about how we can learn to wean ourselves off this excessive attachment to material goods and learn to appreciate more the non-monetary things in life, like love, friendship, good health?
I do go into that in the book. One of the things is to be systematic in our thinking. And so what I try to walk through in the book is, and many of us try to teach our children the distinction first between that which we need and that which we want, because the wants can be almost limitless. The needs are not actually all that great in relation to the things that we want. And so the first thing is having a clear mind and looking at our own lives with honesty about what we really need, and then to look with honesty at the obligation we owe first to our family members and then to our neighbors and to those and to, then to those around the world, I do believe that we have an obligation to be our brother's keeper. I do believe we have an obligation to reach out to those less fortunate. And I think the greatest of the saints have extolled that necessary part of our human condition. And so it's first being honest with ourselves about how we use our money and being honest about the obligation we owe to others, and then setting a bit of a discipline for ourselves to say, you know, the money and time and energy that I give to others should not be the last thing I do, but it should be an integral part of who I am in every day that I live. And again, I want to emphasize, it's not just for people with a lot of money, because even the poorest of the poor have some time and energy of themselves that they can give. Even the poorest of the poor can give something to others, if nothing other than praying for others. And so we all can sacrifice a bit for our neighbors and give something to them.
So, as we've been discussing, money is not an end to itself. What is it, though? How would you define it?
Money is an instrument God has put here for us. Money is a medium of exchange. And one of the reasons it's good is that it allows us to create relationships with one another. And so if you're in one country and I'm in another country, we can actually exchange money for a good or a service and create a relationship. And that those human relationships are good things. But money is just a tool. In a way, it's like the Internet. The Internet is not something to be worshipped or looked at as some salvific thing. It's an instrument we can use for good in terms of communication and relationships, or we can also use it for evil. And there are a number of bad things that can be done with the Internet. And so we need to look at it as something that we can use to grow in virtue, but also something that's risky and that we can use in a bad way that erodes our character.
I was speaking there to Frank Hanna, author of the book What Money Means and How to Use It Well.
Money! Get back!
The president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Cardinal Jean-Louis Thorin, has called for an end to the persecution of Christians in India. Jean-Patrick Lovett reports.
Cardinal Thorin's appeal came in a message to mark the annual Hindu Festival of Light, Diwali. In the message, entitled Christians and Hindus Together in Favour of Non-Violence, Cardinal Thorin praises the figure of Mahatma Gandhi, who he said was a model of non-violence. The cardinal goes on to say that non-violence is not merely a tactical manoeuvre. It's the attitude of one who, in the words of Pope Benedict XVI, is so convinced of God's love and power that he's not afraid to tackle evil with the weapons of love and truth alone. Love of one's enemy, writes Cardinal Thorin, is the revolution of love, a love that does not rely ultimately on human resources, but is a gift of God. I'm Sean Patrick Lovett.
The appeal in favour of non-violence comes in the wake of weeks of anti-Christian violence in the Indian state of Orissa. Hindu extremists in this eastern state have murdered scores of Christians and forced more than 50,000 of them to flee their homes and seek refuge in camps or unofficial settlements. The extremists have destroyed the Christians' homes and livelihoods, burnt dozens of churches, and raped and beaten a number of religious women. Earlier this week, one of the first Christians to suffer a beating at the hands of an angry Hindu mob, Father Bernard Degal, became another victim of the persecution when he died of injuries he sustained 2 months ago. Pope Benedict has decried the killings and riots and called on leaders to spare no effort to ensure the protection of these Christians, whom he said are the victims of intolerance and cruel violence. Reports from Orissa say the situation is still tense with intermittent attacks, but the world's media is no longer shining the spotlight there. So what's the plight of the displaced people like, and are they likely to be able to return to their homes in the near future? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Jennifer Poydatz, who's the country representative for Catholic Relief Services in India.
The population that has been driven out of their homes by force for no reason other than the religion that they practice are traumatized. Many of them have been separated from their loved ones. Many of them have seen their loved ones beaten in front of them, have been witness to these types of atrocities. And I think the other thing that concerns CRS the most is that many of them have been displaced for the second time, because in December, just after Christmas, there was a similar round of violence in Orissa that led to massive displacements as well. So this is the second time many families have been displaced and are now staying in relief camps that have been set up by the government. And hopefully the security situation will improve soon and they will be able to return home and start to rebuild their lives.
You talked about these people, many of them being traumatized. Could you describe, in fact, in more detail what their morale is like? Are they, in fact, too frightened to return home at the moment? Tell me a little bit about their mood.
They're extremely frightened, and they're frightened because they know of others who are still hiding in the forest. They know of others who have tried to return home, but only to be attacked or only to be forced to convert. So the fear is there, and some of them are even saying that they don't want to go home, and that they will never go home, and they need to find, you know, a new place to live and a new place to restart their lives.
Now, this violence has been blamed on Hindu hardliners, but what about the rest of the local non-Christian population there, shall we say, the moderates? Are they sympathetic to the plight of these Christians? Are they talking about it at all?
I think what's important to understand is that this part of Orissa and the population that's being affected is a very poor tribal populations with very few resources and safety nets, whose lives have been turned upside down, whether they're Christian, whether they're Hindu. I mean, life, you know, as it should be in these villages, has come to a standstill. So it's not just the Christian population that's been affected, it's the entire communities. And what's happening is people, when they're threatened, if you don't kind of join with us, you might lose the few things that you own, such as your land and your livelihood. And therefore, you have a situation where, you know, neighbors are being forced to go against neighbors, and that's what's going to make it so difficult to bring these communities back together, because, you know, the tension that's been created and the animosity and the fear all has to be dealt with within communities and with people who used to live, you know, next door to each other.
I mean, in fact, do these displaced people feel that things can never go back to they were before, that, as you say, this tension is so great now and this violence has been going on for quite a long time that it'll be extremely difficult, as you said, to knit things back together?
I think there is a fear. I think some, you know, there is a lot of, when you talk to those who are in the camps, they say, you know, we can't go back, it's too dangerous, and there's nothing left. I mean, our home has been destroyed, or we need to find a new place to live. But then I think the majority of them do want to go back and do want to restart their lives, but there is going to be a need for a lot of support and a coordinated effort for all actors. And I think that's where the church has a big role to play in helping to rebuild communities and bring people back together and to be able to live together again and support each other. And where CRS can play a role is both through our relief activities, but also we look at the longer term, the rehabilitation is building peace building and conflict resolution activities into our recovery efforts in a way that brings communities back together and hopefully restoring the peace that existed before.
But in the short term, do many of these displaced Christians believe that the violence against them is likely to continue?
Yes, I do think the majority of them are still extremely frightened because the incidences of people being attacked and homes being burned are continuing. However, it is getting better, and there is a sign that the security situation is improving, and there is a sign that those who are committing these acts are starting to be arrested and dealt with. But the flip side of that is, as they are arrested, there are protests against them being arrested by the extremist groups. That then again can incite a situation of insecurity.
To sum up very briefly, how do these people see the future?
I think right now they're very concerned. I think right now they're living day to day. I don't think they're thinking about the future. They're thinking about, you know, how are they going to get through another day in the camp? How are they going to make sure that their children are engaged in some type of activity and some semblance of a normal life?
I was speaking there to Jennifer Poydatz of Catholic Relief Services in India. At his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict talked about the role of the cross of Jesus in the preaching of St. Paul. Lydia Kane reports.
St. Paul has become a familiar feature at Pope Benedict's weekly general audience, and this week saw the Holy Father continue his catechesis on this great saint of the Church. Speaking to those gathered in a rather overcast St. Peter's Square, the Holy Father considered the central place of the cross of Jesus Christ in St. Paul's preaching.
Paul's encounter with the glorified Lord on the way to Damascus convinced him that Jesus had died and risen for him and for all. The mystery of the cross showed him the power of God's merciful and saving love. As Paul told the Corinthians, he came not to preach in lofty words or wisdom, but to proclaim Jesus Christ and him crucified. The cross, which seems a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, is a revelation of God's wisdom and strength.
The Pope went on to say that the cross is a sign of God's love for humanity.
On the cross, Christ gave himself up for our sins, becoming a sacrifice of atonement in his own blood. For Paul, facing the crucified Lord, thus calls us to crucify our own flesh with his desires, in order to share in Christ's death and resurrection. In accepting the weakness of the cross, we experience the power of God's love for us.
An estimated 20,000 people gathered in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday, and for some it was their first experience of a general audience.
We're here with a group of musicians, singers and instrumentalists. We're here, we're trying to explore the Dominican roots of our Catholic school. So obviously we're here looking for the Pope today.
Yes, ma'am. First time at papal audience. This is super.
Yes,
incredible.
He is excited.
Very good. Very excited.
Oh, it's great. Seeing people, many people from all over the world coming here to visit this place, the Rome, the Eternal City, and to be with the Holy Father.
In conclusion, Pope Benedict invoked his apostolic blessing on the crowd. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
And that's all from the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.